I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
There's something in the late summer air, and it's got a lot of Georgia folks concerned, along with the people who ask for their votes. And speaking of voting, the timer is running now on the state's new election system, even as a legal fight continues. Meanwhile, the legal battle lines are more clearly drawn now in the showdown over the state's new abortion laws. All that and more coming up in this helping of the Political Breakfast. Welcome. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Theron Johnson, our Democratic strategist, is away, filling in this time Gwinnett County Democratic Chair Bianca Keaton. Republican strategist Brian Robinson is back, though, after some time off. He is a communications consultant and former Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Hey, welcome to both of you.
Glad to be back.
Yeah, good morning.
Good to have both of you back. Bianca, this is your second time. Welcome back.
Yes, thank you for having me
and
again.
Brian, you've been away for a while. I think I recognize you.
Yes, I tried to squeeze in one family vacation, one trip to the Iowa State Fair where I got to watch the other side do their thing in front of the audience.
We're going to get into that in a little bit.
I can't wait to hear.
But first, regulators and elected officials face some very angry residents in Cobb County and again in Newton County after Georgia Health News and WebMD revealed that a medical sterilization plant in Smyrna and another one in the Covington area had submitted emissions data that showed an elevated risk of cancer to nearby neighborhoods. The neighborhoods didn't find out about it until the media reports came out. And it got very complicated after that. But let's take a look at the politics of this, first of all. Brian, let's start with you. Governor Kemp has pushed BD Bard, which is the company in Covington, to do some of the very same things that Sterigenics, the company in Cobb County, has done, promising more transparency, installing equipment or starting to install equipment that might reduce these ethylene oxide emissions. Ethylene oxide, a chemical used in medical sterilization, for one thing. But there are real political risks here, aren't there?
Brian Kemp did exactly what I would have advised him to do if I was sitting around the table there in the governor's office like I used to. He got out in front of this immediately. He didn't wait behind the scenes. He stepped up, said, I'm concerned. I'm going to take action. We're going to get this fixed. So he is out front on it. That's the kind of leadership that I want to see in a crisis. I think the executive has the role and the ability, has the platform to really make an impression with constituents. And the risk of what he has done, and there's always a bit of a risk when you step out there, is that if there continue to be problems, he has made himself the face of the solution to some degree, so he can be a target for complaints on the back end. But if this gets resolved, if he does get action, it's going to be a huge gold star for the Kemp record in the state.
But doesn't he have to also look at resources for the Environmental Protection Division, the state agency involved here, for instance? Because so far, it's relied on voluntary reporting, and there's a lot of skepticism expressed in those town hall meetings about whether the EPD either can be trusted to disclose or whether it has enough resources to just adequately monitor.
There's always going to be a fight for resources and a fight for funding priorities in a state budget where you must have a balanced budget. And this is just one more example. The governor's got the responsibility of balancing those priorities. Let's not forget, we also had to pay teachers and police. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of really important things that we have to do with that money.
But he told agencies just recently, you got to at least get ready for 4% cuts.
Yeah, that's what happens in the real world. If revenues are going down, you make cuts. The only place where that doesn't happen that I know of is the federal government in Washington, and that's going to be my daughter's problem because of reckless spending. So I give credit for Kemp to go out there on the front end and say we're going to tighten our belts. That doesn't mean that there's not going to be the resources there to do the reporting and to do the investigation that the EPD needs to do.
This news story broke maybe about a month ago, and the folks that I saw leading the charge behind it were State Senator Jen Jordan, as well as Eric Allen had been out there.
And he's a state representative from the area. And now members of Congress have gotten involved.
Yeah. You know, the residents were just finding out, and they were building a coalition, a bipartisan coalition of leaders to address this issue. So I think that that push kind of started from the bottom, kind of swelling upward, if you would, as it relates to this crisis.
But if you're Jen Jordan, for instance, and you've already called for the plant, the Sterigenics plant in Cobb County, to be shut down until there's testing to show that the emissions have been reduced to safe levels, are you running a risk that we don't have all the information that we need to even say we should shut down the plant at this point? Are there political risks here for Democrats who have called for the plants to be shut down?
Oh, absolutely. There are going to be risks no matter what happens here. First of all, a serious lapse in trust occurred. When is it ever appropriate to wait or delay telling people that the air that they're breathing could be causing cancer, or that there might be some things that they could modify in their day-to-day while that problem is addressed? So Sterigenics says, hey, we were waiting to tell you because we were trying to work on it or whatever. Well, I would like to see how the difference between the 2018 testing levels and where it is now, since now Cobb County, Smyrna, and Atlanta, City of Atlanta, they're all going to go in and do some testing. I would like to see how that compares. Has Sterigenics actually been doing anything, you know, based on those tests? How long do they take? There are a lot of considerations there, and the risk just continues on while we wait.
I don't think that there's a political risk for Jen Jordan or other Democrats to demand for a shutdown. I don't think there's a political risk in being too extreme on this in any way. It's the advantage of being powerless in the minority. Let's be serious. The downside of being in the minority is you don't get to have your way. You don't have any power. You can't implement your principles, your agenda. The upside is you don't have to be responsible. You don't have to balance things out.
That's
You can just. Look, I've been in the minority. I've been in Congress. You can just like throw bombs. You don't have to worry about the consequences of what you're saying. Everything
I've seen
can
that
be
up close and personal.
And both sides do it. And so, you know, it's very easy to not worry about the practicalities of business or the practicalities of people's livelihoods in those jobs. She's able to stand on the sideline and throw a bomb.
But now, you're diminishing their seat of power because at the end of the day,
I am diminishing their seat of power.
Sterigenics is still a business constituent, you know, a person that is contributing tax dollars, you know, more broadly across the services that are being provided in that community. Sterigenics employs people. There are considerations that will impact people, and there is risk to be shared all around for any elected official coming out on this, no matter what it is they're advocating for, because they're going to make some people happy and they're going to make others upset.
I think the politically easy thing to do is to be against the polluter. And I'm not in any way diminishing the state representative and state senator's voices. And I'm saying also that from a political angle, I would be doing what they're doing. I would be doing the same thing.
Just standing on the sideline
and going, you guys aren't doing enough. People are getting sick. This is a public health threat. And you people are just wringing your hand. That's what I would do, and I don't think that anyone can argue that Brian Kemp or the Congressman Barry Loudermilk or anyone else has been on the sidelines doing nothing. They've been active. They've been involved. But I would do what they're doing.
Bianca, the bigger question here is, are there other situations like this out there that agencies just aren't able to keep track of because they rely so much on voluntary reporting and, in effect, on the honesty of the people who are handling hazardous materials? We have heard for years community activists say we tend to see plants that might have more dangerous materials in them put in areas where there are disadvantaged communities. Is that question, do you think, going to come up as we go through this kind of broadening out beyond these particular episodes.
Absolutely. And if history holds true, usually those are things where a community is suffering or plagued by chronic illnesses. And then, you know, the growth in those illnesses bring rise to some testing, you know, where folks are trying to figure out what the problem is. I do think there should be more required testing to protect the lives of people as we, you know, continue to consume, use, and produce all these toxic chemicals and things that actually impact our lives.
Some of which we rely on, such as the ethylene oxide that sterilizes medical equipment.
Exactly.
Brian, is this possibly, and again, we don't want to get into rank speculation here, but we have to think ahead politically, is this possibly the beginning of a broader examination of where we place things like this in Georgia and who's responsible for making sure that they don't endanger people?
Where we live and where we have growth, population growth, has changed dramatically. It used to be, even 30 years ago, you can just plop it down almost anywhere in Georgia and find a nice piece of green space. And Metro Atlanta is getting increasingly more difficult to do these things in areas that are separated from population centers. And you're also going to see communities respond in different ways for different reasons. If you look in the Smyrna case, it's a fairly small employment pool there, mm-hmm. surrounded by very wealthy areas of the metro area. You look in the Newton County case, however.
They're a big employer there.
It's a big employer, the second biggest in the county. So you've got people, a racially diverse coalition of folks there. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with party, who are supportive of that employer because it's important to their livelihoods. And that involves a bit of a complication there.
Which was exactly my point about the risk, the political risk that those elected leaders will take in advocating.
That's very fair, Bianca. And I want to say that I was speaking more about the Smyrna case because it wasn't a big employer. It wasn't that politically powerful, whereas the Newton County case is somewhat differently. That has got more there's more political risk in being against that, which interestingly is why you haven't seen any Newton County officials coming out and bashing this company there.
Barred. Yeah.
And one thing with Brian Kemp's angle that's interesting there is he has a lot of Newton County senior staff. His chief of staff, Tim Fleming, is from Newton County. Tim's father is or was a county commissioner, so prominent in that community. His COO lives in Covington as well. So you've got people who have children in that community coming in and looking him down every day. So you got to think that they're very concerned about that community and want to make sure it's safe.
And you're right, Brian. It has been folks in both parties who are kind of landing in different sides of this issue about whether the plant should close or not while further testing is done. But on a broader question, we've seen, and Bianca, I'll start with you. You may have noticed that over the last few years, we've seen more state Republican leaders move toward positioning themselves as environmental advocates. Tim Echols, the Public Service Commissioner, one of the folks responsible for regulating the state's utilities, has been pushing electric cars, has been pushing solar power, while also advocating the completion of the Plant Vogtle nuclear project. Are we seeing Democrats looking at an issue, the environment, public health, where Republicans are starting to pay more attention to things that Democrats have been saying?
I support all this work moving forward, but it is late. You know, Republicans have allowed this plant to languish to such a degree that now it's going to cost lots and lots of money to repair from years of neglect.
Brian, are we seeing Republicans take another look, let's say, at environmental issues and have to balance what we talked about just a bit ago, the need to attract employers versus the need for public health and environmental concerns and regulations? And Tim Echols, just to name one, has been one of the folks who's been kind of positioning himself that way.
Yeah, but you know, Tim has been positioning himself that way for
a long time. Yeah, that's why I brought him up.
Yeah, he ran for the PSC in 2010 and has always been very open on those issues. And he's a unicorn. And first, let me say Tim is a loyal listener of Political Breakfast. So hi, Tim. And thank you for the Twitter support you always give us. He's a unicorn in that he is a social conservative. He's part of that
Well, he came up through the evangelical Christian movement, Christian youth movement, really.
And still very involved in that. But at the same time, is someone who's very comfortable in an NPR station doing interviews about solar power. And I think what Tim is actually shows the complexity of what our political system really is. If you dug in, we all like to believe, you know, you're either in America Today pro-Trump or anti-Trump, and you believe everything Trump believes, or you hate everything he believes, and that's where everybody is. And that's not the case. It's much more complex than that. And you know, obviously, Bianca and I both play partisan roles here to some degree. But if you dug down on my political beliefs, it's a lot more complex than just what's in the news of the day. I don't agree with everything Donald Trump says, and I don't disagree with everything that Barack Obama said.
But you're really hard on Stacey Abrams.
Stacey Abrams, the former Democratic gubernatorial candidate, Bianca, started her expanded Fair Fight 2020 initiative in your neck of the woods. You were there at Gwinnett County's Annistown Elementary School, where there were long lines because of voting problems back in 2018. Brian says, okay, you know, Stacey Abrams needs her facts checked. I'm assuming, Brian, you're talking about intentional voter suppression,
right,
which she is alleging. But there were voting problems at Annistown Elementary, and people wondered whether their votes would count. But Bianca, is Stacey Abrams here taking on an issue where she will be checked more closely on the allegations that she's making, because she's expanding her platform? She's expanding her network, if you will, of folks who are checking, monitoring voting and election systems.
Voter suppression has common themes. And what we saw at Annistown, I won't go so far as to say it was intentional, but there was a lack of training and resources provided that led to those missteps at that particular precinct, where the cards were not the appropriate cards for that location. And so you had folks showing up, and I was there. We had also been to Anderson Livesey. They didn't have power cords over there. And so in all of these instances, there are these mishandlings of sorts. Those are mistakes that are really hard to explain, but can be substantiated. So the idea that, you know, there's this fraud, these are people, voters, who went to the polls and experienced very severe irregularities.
Here's my concern, my macro level concern as a Southerner and as a Georgian who's very proud of the progress that we've made, is that when you talk about voter suppression in the context of a Deep South state, there is a racial connotation. And I don't think that she being Stacey Abrams, shies away from the racial connotations, that there is a white conspiracy to suppress the votes of people of color by not having power cords at a voter station. That's absurd and it's offensive. And what gets left out of the story is when Abrams tells these stories about voter suppression, there often is some grain of truth, like something went awry, as Bianca was demonstrating with very good examples, is that often those mistakes are colorblind. You know, when we were talking about shutting down precincts because of Americans with Disability Act requirements, it was not targeted at African Americans. It happened sometimes in pro-Trump precincts that got closed down. I witnessed it at a state house race in the Athens area. My thing is, there are problems, let's fix them. But the idea that there's this racial suppression, which is the connotation, is wrong, and it hurts us.
The last time I was here, you and I talked about how instead of using race, instead of using a party and gerrymandering, people focus on race. So you acknowledge that race is actually used in determining strategy for how to draw lines so that you can pack the districts with voters that are most likely to be Republican or Democrat and grow your seats or dilute the power of, you know, the opposing party. Well, in this particular case, we had precincts that were, for the most part, black precincts. You're talking 70-80% of voters in these precincts being voters of color, going to their precincts and having these issues occur.
So you're saying the effects are disproportionately on minority communities?
Exactly. We didn't hear about these types of issues occurring in precincts that had large shares of white voters. So when we're talking about this, we're saying, hey, look at this. There is a pattern here. And what I'm hearing from you is that you don't want to see that pattern there, but you're more willing to lean on that when it benefits you and the gerrymandering.
I think that there's an assumption sometimes when something goes wrong in a majority-minority precinct that there was some grand conspiracy. And look, state government and no one in it is smart enough and organized enough to carry off a grand conspiracy.
But it is safe to say Georgia is going to be under the microscope when
yes.
it comes to this next election.
Oh, no doubt about that. Oh, we're in total agreement.
On that subject, federal judge Amy Totenberg told Georgia it can use its current voting machine system one more time this fall in a handful of state and municipal elections, some special elections and so forth. But it will have to have some form of paper record by the presidential primaries next March 24th. So the meter is running. The judge even quoted that great legal scholar Yogi Berra saying it'll be deja vu all over again with legal fights over election validity if the system is not changed. Brian, it's a question we've raised before on this podcast. The Secretary of State, the new one, Brian Raffensperger, who, to continue the baseball analogy, is a rookie here, is facing a huge challenge now. How quickly is the mobilization going forward?
The heat is on Brad Raffensperger. And here's somebody with a business background who has run large, complex organizations. He's going to need that skill set to get this done. And look, he holds the bag, right? He's holding the bag. If this goes well, he deserves to have a portrait put of him in the Capitol. If it goes bad, he's going to have a serious political liability. But the power is in his hands to do the right thing and to deliver for the people.
Bianca, a group of advocates, though, is continuing the lawsuit, which is asking the judge to block the implementation of the new system, saying the machines are not secure enough. They do print out a voter's choices, but the actual counting mechanism is embedded in a barcode. And the advocates say you can't verify your choices really because where they're hidden is in a barcode. At what point, though, do you say, look, guys, we got to try this new system. Let's get behind it. Or do you continue the fight?
Why not erase all doubt by making it as plain as possible? And I don't think the barcode is more is that much easier than having it the other way.
But at what point do you say, look, we got to try this new system. How do we know it doesn't work until we try it? And it's certainly more reliable.
That is a very expensive test.
Yeah.
Okay. And hand-marked paper ballots are the cheapest and the safest option.
Going back some decades when we had hand-marked paper ballots in Georgia and there were allegations of ballot box stuffing. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go back to some of Georgia's gubernatorial elections in decades past, in the mid-20th century, there were plenty of problems with those. Now, obviously, we've come a long way since then.
Yeah.
But are we ever going to have a system that is free from questions? And I guess the question now is, the judge is saying, look, we can't use the old system. We got to have something.
I do think that technology can be used to some extent to make sure that people aren't able to stuff ballots in boxes, to make sure that the folks that came in to vote were the ones that had their ballots counted. And we can implement some systems for that.
But is there another challenge for Secretary Raffensperger in all of this, Brian, which is not only do the machines themselves have to be reliable in the counting process, they have to be secure from hacking. And that was one of the accusations made against his predecessor, now Governor Brian Kemp, when he was Secretary of State, that he didn't do enough.
I don't know that anybody has the wherewithal and the knowledge that can promise to stay ahead of the hackers and stay ahead of cyber criminals. I think it's an impossible standard to hold public officials to. That said, I do want to see them communicating on that, Dennis. I want them to be out talking to Georgians about what we're trying to do to prevent that from happening, to build public trust. We do need to be out there proactively communicating on cyber defense.
And we'll jump to the top of the ticket in just a moment. Some Democratic presidential candidates visited Georgia, and Brian Robinson went out and visited some of the Democrats in Iowa. That and more when the Political Breakfast returns. Stay right here.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And we are back with the Political Breakfast. Thanks for hanging out with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is away this week. Filling in this time, Gwinnett County Democratic Chair Bianca Keaton. And returning after a bit of an absence, Republican strategist Brian Robinson. Before we get to your visit to Iowa, Brian, let's talk about the Democratic candidates who visited Georgia. We saw Cory Booker, Pete Buttigieg, Julian Castro, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who all showed up to speak to young African-American church leaders from around the country at a conference at the Georgia International Convention Center. But when you look at how this might affect the Georgia primary, did anybody who visited create some momentum, some groundwork for the Georgia primary, which is going to be quite late in the cycle and where African-American voters, including these young leaders, are going to be very, very important?
Those visits will be important in the long run. There were a lot of folks that reached out to me that day. Unfortunately, there were so many events I was not able to attend. But there were folks that I didn't even know to be politically engaged that actually attended. So I do think that there was some benefit from that. But what I am still waiting for are for these candidates to make their way around to the other parts of the state. Elizabeth Warren, so far, is the only one in the race now that has actually made that stop in Gwinnett. And I think that whoever is going to obtain that the Democratic nomination out of Georgia, they need to be making that stop in Gwinnett, and they need to make that stop in Augusta. I know Pete Buttigieg has visited there once before, and they need to go down south, too. They need to go to Macon or Albany
and Savannah.
Or Savannah. Yeah.
I wouldn't do any of those things if I was them. And here's why. One, we're a late primary state, right? So we should not be where they're coming to do anything other than raise money because Atlanta does have a significant—
Well, trust us, they will do that.
And that's what they're doing. That's a lot of what this is. We are also a major center of African-American national leaders. And so you'll have a lot of conferences that sort of are geared toward elite African-American society here in Atlanta. And that's an important Democratic constituency. And you also have a burgeoning just Democratic circles here. And so if I was a Democrat, if I was in Georgia, I'd be getting on TV here because it's a major media market. I would be trying to make sure that the national media outlets that have correspondents here are covering my events. And I'd probably go to Gwinnett County because it's gotten to be a huge Democrat county now. I mean, I'm a huge county that's got now majority Democrat. And now Cobb County is very competitive, and Democrats were going to argue that it's now a blue county because Hillary Clinton won it. So if I was a Democrat, one, if I came to Georgia, it'd be to raise money. And two, I wouldn't get outside of Metro Atlanta for now.
And why? But you're
and
including
leave it to a Republican strategist to tell you how to win a Democratic nomination.
That's right? Fair. That's completely fair criticism. Completely fair.
And what I'm saying is, the Democrats in Georgia are tired of the same old, same old. They're tired of people going and pitching their flag in the metro Atlanta and saying that that's it. Georgia's a big state.
Is that why, Bianca, a lot of Democratic leaders in this state, not all of them, but many of them are kind of keeping their powder dry with endorsements? They're waiting to see who comes to visit. They're waiting to see who pays attention. We have Mayor Bottoms, who's already endorsed former Vice President Joe Biden. A couple of others, State House Minority Leader Bob Trammell endorsed Kamala Harris. And there are one or two others, but you don't see a lot of the Democratic leaders rushing forward to pick a candidate right now.
I think there is some hesitation to see who emerges in that top echelon. So you don't want to waste your political capital on someone that's never going to get the nomination. And I do think that it will be interesting. I'll just say that. It will be interesting. They have picked who they want, I think, even though they may not say it. They want to give the impression of impartiality. But I think most of us already know who we want.
But the Democratic candidates got that much coveted visit from Brian Robinson in Iowa. You went out there, and we should say you went out there because it's always been part of something you've always wanted to do, to go out to the Iowa State Fair where they have the soapbox speeches and all of that. I wanted to ask you, though, before you even get into who did well, would it have been more fun if you had gone 4 years ago and heard that flock of candidates from your own party, or was it more fun to go this time and watch the other side?
I don't think anything could have beaten the chaos and scene caused by Donald Trump's helicopter landing during Hillary Clinton's visit to the state fair. That happened 4 years ago, which that would have been monumental, a trip for the ages. Mine was very low key. I got to see Joe Biden. He was the kickoff speaker for the most part on the first day of the fair. I believe I was the first person to tweet that, and therefore to report from the scene, that he said, we choose truth over facts. And that later kind of caught on as one of his gaffes of the week. But I think I was the first one to do it, standing there with a Washington Post reporter who kind of looked at me and laughed. And I saw Klobuchar and Gillibrand. They both had a lot of grassroots operation there. Also saw a lot of the also-rans, your Tim Ryans, your Hickenloopers, and Inslee, who are both out.
Out now.
And so it was interesting seeing what kind of crowd that they drew. Klobuchar had a huge crowd. I was there for 4 days, but I had to catch my flight, so I missed Booker and Warren, and I would have loved to have seen Elizabeth Warren, and then Buttigieg wasn't until the next week. So those were three that I really wanted to see that I didn't get to see.
And these are hardcore, you know, Democrats who are going to be watching all of the soapbox speeches. Do you get a sense of anybody in that key early state who seems to be generating more enthusiasm than the others? Or, as we've been saying before here in Georgia, is everybody just sort of, okay, I'm just going to wait and see. I need to meet these people some more before I decide what I'm going to do.
Biden, in the little corn kernel poll they have there, had the same significant lead in that straw poll than he has nationwide. You saw in Iowa, perhaps Klobuchar have a bit of an edge. I think probably get a little more of a crowd there than she would in another state because she's from right next door in Minnesota and has this Iowa connection and was able to get people. There are people in the audience from Minnesota who'd come down for her. And so that was an advantage. It may give her some ground troops on the ground if she makes it to the caucuses next year.
Bianca, are Georgia Democrats watching the early states like Iowa, like New Hampshire, especially given the much more diverse voter base of Democrats here than in those two states?
You've heard a lot of Georgia Democrats kind of be quiet. And, you know, I think there is some intention in that Georgia Democrats expect these presidential candidates to come and spend that time here, mm-hmm. To help voters here get to know them.
Late as Georgia is in the cycle, will Iowa and New Hampshire matter to Georgia Democrats? Are they really paying that much attention?
I think Georgia Democrats might actually swing it potentially in another direction, which is the benefit that we do have of going a little bit later. And I'm curious to see how things shake out in those earlier states, but I don't know that it will have much of an impact on how people are going to vote here. You know, just looking at the field of organizers and people that have gone out to work for some of these presidential candidates, stakes are in the ground. They've been in the ground for a long time. And
you're talking about here.
Here in Georgia. And that's why I think that it's really important for those candidates to spend some time outside of Atlanta and do more than collect those checks and, you know, from fundraisers and things like that. Because after a campaign like Stacey Abrams and Sarah Riggs-Amico going around the state and spending lots of quality time with voters, voters here, Democratic voters, are going to want that. They're going to expect that.
Shifting to a battle that is very much afoot in Georgia, and where Georgia could be the place where it's decided. The state has asked a federal judge to dismiss the lawsuit against House Bill 480. This is the bill that would ban most abortions in the state once a heartbeat can be detected. It goes into effect on January 1st. a group of opponents is asking the judge to say, okay, we're going to block enforcement of the law until the challenges go all the way through the court system. And Attorney General Chris Carr's office is arguing the state has a legitimate legal interest in protecting life during pregnancy. Brian, I'm going to start with you. We have other states with similar laws, but Georgia has this extra provision that some of them don't have, which is this personhood provision, which grants legal status as a person to fertilized eggs, in effect. So are we looking at, because of that, something where Georgia could be the case that decides it all, and Attorney General Carr and others playing a very prominent role in that?
It would certainly be a tremendous platform for Attorney General Chris Carr. And, you know, what he has done here for him politically in Georgia is pretty important. He's got pretty strong language in there that's going to be very appealing to Republican voters.
You know, in his argument to the court against the injunction, yeah.
Yeah. Certainly a very strong pro-life argument. And that's going to be very important for him as he faces elections in the future, going into Republican primaries for perhaps a different office like U.S. Senate and that kind of thing. This will be one of the things that he can hang his hat on as a bona fide of a tried and true conservative. So it's an important move for him. And look, just like with Brad Raffensperger having a big case on his hands and he's got the chance to prove himself, this is that opportunity for Chris Carr. This is his opportunity to prove himself. You know, the Democrats in 2018, their attack on Chris was his background wasn't as an in-court attorney. You know, mm-hmm. He had been a chief of staff for Senator Isaacson. He had been the commissioner of the Department of Economic Development. If he can carry this through, that will no longer be an argument you can make against him.
The law of the land, the federal law, allows women to have abortions.
This is the Roe versus Wade decision,
yes,
going back to 1973.
Exactly. And so what we have here, it's just a Republican attempt to tear that down. And in the process, you have these folks that have had careers in all these areas, like you said. But the thing that I'm missing in that is I don't hear the medical degree. I don't hear any of that while they're over here talking about medical decisions for women. And in his motion to dismiss, he says that abortion is not health care. It is not medical care. How do you, an attorney, decide that when you have the whole medical community telling you something completely different? And here is a case where I think Republicans have placed their ideology over fact, over all the advice of people that actually built the medical institution and things that we rely on today. And when I was here last time, I mentioned my life would seriously be in jeopardy were I to become pregnant again. I did not realize that in my first pregnancy that I would become a risk for stroke, or that I would have to be on bed rest, and that all these other things would happen. And, you know, thank God my daughter was here, but I continued to suffer complications even after birth. And this was premature delivery. It was all the things. And, you know, I was advised, were I to get pregnant again, this could happen and happen much earlier in the pregnancy. So fortunately for me, these complications came when I was close to safely delivering. And it was a matter of just trying to figure out how to prolong it to get to that point where the baby, you know, was more developed. You cannot tell me what that experience is like. It is very personal for me. And so I don't want to hear it. I don't want anyone telling me that if I needed to have an abortion to save my life, that I don't have that choice to do so, or that I can't even be fearful about what might happen if it came along later, because there could be additional complications that come up and you just can't account for that. Those are decisions that need to be made by women, their families, and their doctors. So stay out of my uterus, period.
Brian, to her point, because Georgia's law is so sweeping, even compared to those in other states, if Georgia becomes the test case, have those on the pro-life side overplayed their hand by including provisions that might be vulnerable, the way that Bianca is describing, to being tossed out?
I do want to clarify that as far as I know, the circumstances that Bianca is describing, and look, my wife was on bed rest too, and I know the fear that the parent feels with the fear of early birth, because I've gotten those dire doctor warnings too. But I do think that in Bianca's circumstance, that this law would allow for an abortion where her life, another mother's life, was in danger. There was a stroke risk, et cetera. That's real life. What she's describing is real life. And I don't think that there's people on the Republican side that deny that. I mean, I talk with numerous Republican legislators. They wrestle with some of this as they were voting because, on the one hand, they do believe on a fundamental level that they are saving human lives. So they are saving innocent human lives. And if you see it through that perspective, it changes how you look at this. But all of them, many of them too, had complicated pregnancies or had spouses with complicated pregnancies or had friends with a problem. So that's always going to be an issue. But I think for Republicans, the bottom line is, the way they approach it is, we're saving innocence.
When you talk about that, like, you're injecting government into my uterus, into my womb. And it puts eyes of all these other people, the police and other folks, into my situation that should be between me, my family, and my doctor. And then have harsh and very severe penalties.
Real quickly, this case and Georgia's new voting system have put what had been kind of, we always call them down ballot positions, very much not only in the public eye, but in a partisan political way where they perhaps hadn't been before. Attorneys general are, including Chris Carr, are taking positions either because they feel it's their job or because of political belief, where they are attracting partisan debate in a way perhaps that they haven't before. There's a whole group of Democratic attorneys general that's taking on President Trump over the issue of immigration. New York's state attorney general, Letitia James, has been very prominent, a Democrat, going after President Trump on his finances, for instance. So are we seeing, and I'll throw this out to both of you, are we seeing these offices, attorney general, for instance, which had normally been considered kind of not only less prominent, but less partisan, becoming just as partisan as other offices that, such as president or Congress?
You know, Georgia has not been on the forefront of that, and it's because of our constitutional system. It has nothing to do with Attorney General Carr or any of his predecessors. You know, in Georgia, we have a particularly strong governor system. The governor really controls everything, one of the most powerful governors in the entire country.
Even though the Attorney General is elected and the Secretary of State are elected separately. They're not appointed by the governor.
That's right. And so it's difficult for an attorney general in Georgia to have a high profile because they're not empowered to make decisions the way the governor is here and the way attorneys general are in other states. That's why when Carr gets a situation like this abortion law, it is an opportunity to have a very high profile role. And what he has been doing, given the circumstances of what he has, is focusing on issues of victimization, sex crimes, for example, has been elder abuse.
Trafficking.
These are things that he has focused on and messaged on continually to raise his profile on those issues. So this is another opportunity for him to do it.
You know, right now, you know, the Democratic Party doesn't really have much room to push back on a lot of that stuff outside of the courts, which is why the courts have become the next foray in how these fights are being fought. And then what we're seeing are in some of the counties and the localities that are more Democratic, that they're pushing back and defending their constituents mm-hmm. and their right to govern as they see the law, not as the law is being fed
and
to them.
And this is where we come back to what Paul Howard in Fulton and Sherry Boston in DeKalb are saying, which is they either won't enforce the law or they side with the ACLU on this.
Right. And, you know, Georgia is a it is more purple than red.
Purpling.
Well, it's about to be blue. It's about to be blue. So the purpling is about to be complete, and then we're going to be blue.
It's only blue if you actually win, not well, the election was stolen, therefore we're blue.
You know what?
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Filling in for Democratic strategist Theron Johnson this time, Gwinnett County Democratic Chair Bianca Keaton. Hey, thanks to you both. Really appreciate it.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And if you like this show, subscribe, and you can do that wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure that other people can find us. We will be back in your feed and in your head real soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.